Chapter 1. One night, in the Hotel du Pekin, a man uttered a statement which was to sentence me to more hardship and privation than I had ever before known, and to more danger, and to more high adventure than I had thought possible in this commonplace world. Leaning on the bar and looking at me, bleary-eyed, Charlie Martin said,
"All Mongolians are rich."
Not much, but enough. Why were they rich? Certainly it wasn't commerce, and it wasn't agriculture. That nomadic people, now that I came to think of it, had no visible means of support, and yet they were all rich. I am not what you'd call a romantic adventurer, neither an adventurer nor a romantic. I don't happen to like the sound of either. What I've done has come under the head of experience, and perhaps exploit, and sometimes conquest. You might even call me hard-headed, determined to get what I want where I want it, and that, to my everlasting sorrow, is not a fitting or a fit code for any man. I know all these things now, and I didn't then. I know entirely too much how wrong I was. I've seen things since that night in the Hotel du Pekin, which even now I can't believe I have seen. But the mental scars are there. Had you asked me, there at the bar, "Do you believe in God?" I would have replied, "Well, yes and no." And in a bigoted way, I would have explained a very complex conception to you. Now, to the same question, I would say, "I don't know. I've never had any great proof of God, but I know there's a hell. Lost up there in the Gobi, I found it." In a careless way, you've heard men say, "I went to hell and back to get that." They didn't mean hell, really. But I do. This gold beside me, that diamond in this ring, I went to hell and brought them back. Up there, lost in the Gobi, there's a mountain with a name so sacred to Mongols that even here I dare not write it. Why? Because that mountain has a festering wound in the craggy side, and through that wound, men pass on their journey to hell. Charlie Martin knew a lot about such things. He was an archaeologist attached to a museum, and he looked at all things in a sober, academic light. He went on to expound his theory of why Mongolians were all rich, and it was too common for repetition. As I parted with him that night, my mind was already dwelling on a wild idea which had come to me. I said, in a careless sort of way, "I think I'll take a run up to Kalgan, and maybe beyond in a few days."
"Country's pretty wild right now. Watch yourself."
I would have done very well to have heeded his advice, but I didn't. I was too immersed in this idea of mine. All Mongolians were rich, and they didn't have mines. But the Gobi was a big place, and who knew what you could find in those flat-topped scarps which rose like a child's blocks out of the gravelly waste. 2 days later, I was on my way. Thanks to Charlie, I had a letter to the Prince of East Sung, a man very influential in the country, and I anticipated no difficulties. You see, simple fool that I am, I thought that there would be gold up there. And if there was, what would hinder my scouting around, finding it, and staking out a claim? I had a small gasoline-driven dry panner with which to test those gravelly washes where no water ever flowed. Gold is a driving force. It had taken me on a wild trek through the country of the ancient Mayas until the Yucatan Indians had driven me out. It had taken me through the upper forgotten mountains of Ecuador and through the endless wilderness of northern Canada. I knew gold, but little else. I had a degree in mining, but the soberer jobs left me cold. I always managed to make my stake and keep going. Nothing terribly rich, but enough. A mining engineer, when he takes the prospector's trail, doesn't experience very much difficulty. He can pass the old sourdoughs with their odd ideas, and he can guess at things the so-called practical miner never suspects exist.